I think this is the Blue Dot Report, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom, but maybe it's the Oktoberfest edition. In fact, it is. Today, for our Pledge Drive special, this is a live one-hour special here at NSPR, and we're talking about the science of brewing beer. And our guest today is Terrence Sullivan. He's the product manager and brewery ambassador at the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company here in Chico, California. He got his Bachelor of Science degree from the University of California, Davis in 1994. And during his studies, he worked for the Robert Mondavi Winery in Napa Valley. He later worked for Golden Pacific Brewing Company in Emeryville, and then he joined Sierra Nevada in May 1994. Terrence, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
We talked on the phone a little bit yesterday, and I was just so impressed by the depth of your knowledge about the science of beer. I have to admit that I love drinking beer, and I enjoy beer, but I don't really know that much about the science of beer. So I'm going to be learning along with our listeners today. So all of you out there, I'm going to be getting geeked out on beer right along with the rest of you. So let's start out with, give us an overview of, what's the history of beer? How old is it? It's an ancient beverage, isn't it?
Yeah, over 7,000 years old. It's, it came about before wine was even discovered. People were harvesting grains and making breads, and literally, they assumed that somehow water got in with the bread, started fermentation process. Yeast is alive. It's a living organism. It's in space.
They didn't even really know what was going on. They just knew that it was happening, and then they drank it and liked it.
Well, the effects of alcohol, yes. That's what they enjoyed. And then that's when they discovered that, we can actually control this.
When did we learn to control the process? When did the actual craft of starting to actually brew beer? When was the beginnings of that?
Well, the ancient Sumerians were the ones that were really starting to actually grind grains, add water, let the fermentation process begin.
And then what was it like, say, like in the medieval period? What kind of brewing process was going on then?
Probably a lot of bad brewing, just from what they had available to them. A lot of stuff was done in wood. The control that we have nowadays with stainless steel and copper, and copper was really one of the first metals that was really used in the brewing process, because copper was a great conductor of heat, so it was very easy to use that. Nowadays we've learned that copper somewhat beneficial to fermentation, and yeast actually can use some of the copper, but copper can be a big oxidizer of beer, and actually is not the preferred type of metal that's used. It's stainless steel nowadays.
Let's talk about like the scientific revolution and the development of simple things that we take for granted today, like the thermometer, and the and the ability to measure the specific gravity of beer. How did that affect brewing as a process?
Well, temperature is very, very important, and that's like one of the differences between beer and making wine is beer is actually a science. There's a science involved. Enzymatic reactions, all sorts of things like that actually makes it a true science. And probably the key factor was the microscope. So Louis Pasteur and the microscope is really looking at what is going on inside the fermentation process and the yeast cell converting sugars, fermentable sugars, into alcohol. And that was the key driver, in my personal opinion, what I've read.
Give us an overview, for people who maybe not know, haven't been on the brewery tour, for example, and I highly recommend, if you find this interesting, the Sierra Nevada brewing tour is very educational.
Yes.
And fascinating. And at the end, you do get to sample the wares, which is always fun. Take us just through the process, the modern process of how is beer made for somebody who doesn't really know.
Right. So the key is grain. That's what I always say. the yeast being the livelihood of the beer, and then the grain is like the body of the beer, and then your hops are your spice of the beer. So you start off with grain, and it's barley that is malted. And so brewers generally buy malted barley from a maltster. During that process, what happens is the maltster is adding water, and he's letting the grain partially germinate. So it's actually starting, it develops rootlets. It's starting to develop the stem that would be the plant. During that, you're taking carbohydrates and you're converting the carbohydrates into starches. And then that's what we need as brewers, is the starches is what brings on the sugars for us. So during the brewing process, what we're going to do is we're going to take that grain, we're going to grind it, turn it into a flour. And that's part of the science too. You don't want to grind it too much because you want the husk intact. The husk actually becomes a filter aid in the lautering process. So what you're going to do, crack that grain, add some water, and then this is where the science really starts. And you're adding the water and you're controlling a temperature. There is enzymes that are present on the husk, just inside the husk layer and on the husk layer of the grain, and that's alpha amylase and beta amylase. Beta amylase, well, both of the enzymes work at slightly different temperatures and also pH dependent, but just for this process is really temperature. So you control the temperature of what's now called your mash. And if you're at home and you're making oatmeal, mash looks like oatmeal, you know, in its early stages. Mm-hmm. So that mash, if you work at cooler temperatures, say about 148 degrees, you have beta enzyme that is very active at that point. Alpha amylase, that enzyme, becomes active around 156 degrees Fahrenheit at the optimal temperature. So you control your temperature of your mash depending on the style of beer you want to make.
So that's the key, is knowing exactly, you know, what temperature you're working at to control those enzymes and what they're doing.
Yeah, and literally a half a degree will make a difference on, like, you know, we're drinking Celebration Ale and it's 6.8% alcohol. Literally that half a degree can get you out of legal alcohol level. Like if you're too low, your alcohol is gonna rise. So what happens at that, the beta amylase, what it does is I call it a chewer. So a starch molecule is nothing more than a long chain of sugars joined together, right? Beta amylase chews on the ends of that starch molecule and creates fermentable sugars. Alpha amylase is a cleaver. So it takes that starch molecule and just starts chopping it. Wherever it joins that starch molecule, it'll chop it. And that creates non-fermentable sugars. So depending on that temperature of 148 to 156 degrees, you can now start to drive the style of beer you want to make. You want to make a really dry beer, higher in alcohol, you work down in the 148 to 150 degree range. If you want to make a very sweet, not so high alcohol beer, you start working up in the upper thresholds of 156 to 158 degrees, and that will actually.
So this is what happens when kids, you know, that like doing chemistry experiments get to be a little older, and then they start to play with the real fun chemistry,
right?
Because beer, it really is a fascinating biochemistry.
And I always loved science, and I was going to UC Davis, and I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I went to visit my brother for the summer up in Ashland, Oregon, and he was working for Rogue Breweries on their one of their little satellite systems. And I went up there and spent a month with him and made beer with him. And I realized, oh, UC Davis has a fermentation.
And is that what got
program.
You hooked on?
That's actually what got me into making beer. And
how did you get hooked up with Sierra Nevada? Because you've been there for quite a while.
Oh, that's a long story.
Can you give us the short version?
Yeah. I actually so when we were going to school, we were sponsored. So Anheuser-Busch gave a lot of money to UC Davis, and so for the students. They would actually hook us up with like conferences, industry conferences, and things like that. And so I actually went to San Luis Obispo. I think it cost us $20 as kids when we were going to school, which was, you know, really cool. We got a university car and a gas card and free lodging. And so we went down to San Luis Obispo, and I met a couple of the brewers from Sierra Nevada, Steve Dressler, our head brewmaster that's been there 33 years. Met him there, and as we always say, it sparked up a friendship. And from that point on, he had told me that there was an opening at Sierra Nevada, and sent him my
resume. Been there ever since?
And been there ever since, and I love it. I mean, it's family-owned. It's great, great business. Our owner, Ken Grossman, and his family are
Very proud to be, in a community with such a fabulous business. Yeah. And what a wonderful business model they are with all the sustainable practices and everything. Let's get back to beer. Go ahead.
Okay, so making the beer, right? You got this mash, right? And you got this enzymatic reaction. Literally instantaneous it happens when you add the moisture and you have the temperature. So you do that mash, and then you have to filter it. And that's where you have to filter what's called the sweet wort from that mash. And so it's wort, and then it becomes beer once we add yeast to it. So during the lautering process, so in essence, it's a giant sieve. The husk, as I talked about, a little more dense than the grain particles, that will actually adhere to the bottom of the vessel, and it becomes a filter aid. So that husk, if you can think about it, I mean, yes, it is small, but it'll literally filter the grain particles. Hold them back as you're taking now that sweet wort off. And then we do a process called sparging, where we're going to leach out the sugar. That sugar will be bound inside the grain particles as well as in the liquid. So we want to get as much out of the grain as we possibly can. So we do that louder process, run that wort off. Then we boil the wort, and that stabilizes it, concentrates it, and stabilizes it in the meaning of killing off any kind of bacteria or any kind of airborne yeast, so that we're using a sterile yeast that we propagate up, and then we add that to that sweet wort, add some hops to get bitterness and to get flavor and aroma from the hops. That's that spice that I talked about. Then you add the yeast, and then off it goes, put it in a vessel where it can't get oxygen, and now it's going to start to ferment. So, and then we have beer.
So, yes, and you brought some 2015 celebration IPA, this wonderful beer. I just had a taste of it. It's got a lovely flavor. How long does it take to go from, okay, we're going to make this, how long does it take to make an ale like this?
Generally speaking, ales are roughly 14 to 18 days, depending on going back to, higher alcohol is going to take a little bit longer. Low alcohol beer is pretty quick. Pale ale, for instance, 14 days. But we do a bottle conditioning process with several of our beers, not all of them. But that bottle conditioning process takes another 14 days, roughly about 10 days.
We're going to be going into break here in just a moment. But before we do, I want to kind of tease what we're going to talk about next. I'd like to next talk about the role of water, what that plays. Yeah. I know growing up, beer commercials were always about, it's the water.
Absolutely.
So I would like to know, what is it about the water that enhances beer? So now is the time for you to show your support for this radio station, bringing this wonderful special on the science of brewing beer, and hopefully later today. And it's, as I'm told, it's noon somewhere. It's drinking hour somewhere in the world. So if you'd like to open a bottle of Celebration Ale or Pale Ale or whatever you like to drink and join us, feel free to do so. Here's the number to call. Talking about the science, craft, and art, and science of brewing beer, and there's so much involved in it. But the main ingredient of beer, of course, is H2O. Yep. Tell us a little bit about the role that water has in different kinds of water. Like, for example, Sierra Nevada's opened a new brewery in North Carolina.
Correct.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the difference between regional waters and how that affects the taste of beer.
Yeah, and you know, we discovered when we were going to build a brewery out there, and we decided that was one of the first things that we actually looked at is the water composition. We found that the water is amazing in North Carolina. We have some wells on site that we actually use for the brewing process. Where at Chico, we use city water, and we've always used city water. And what we found was quite a difference. And Mills River, very soft water, much easier to actually brew with. So the less minerals you actually have in the water is you can add back depending on the style of beer you're actually making. So it's much easier for us there, where in Chico we got to strip a little bit and then we add back to the water here in Chico. And you know, it was kind of funny. You know, Ken started the brewery 35 years ago.
Ken Grossman, yes.
And started the brewery 35 years ago. Actually, next month will be our 35th anniversary. And, you know, it was a college town and it was a cool place to live. And that's why he started it here. And now in hindsight, when we look at it, it's like, oh, I don't know, you know, water-wise, I don't know if we would build a brewery in Chico again, you know. But one of the things is where water actually plays a part in the actual style of beer. Literally, you know, hundreds of years ago, beer styles came about in certain regions, and it was all due to the water quality and the water composition. So you look, for instance, we're coming out with a new beer this next year, and it's called a Goza style ale. Goza is a type of beer, and it came from a region of Germany that their groundwater was saturated with salt. And so it actually has a salty finish to that style of beer, because that was the water that they were given to make beer. I mean, people still wanted beer, so you got to use the water that's available. And so if you actually look at, you know, Burton-on-Trent, where pale ales and IPAs became famous, it was really due to the water that was there. Very hard water, high in calcium sulfate. And so that calcium sulfate hardens the water. It gives more of a bite or backbone. Really, a lot of the body of that beer comes from the calcium sulfate. So if you're making an IPA or a beer that tends to be on the higher side of bitter and accentuates hops, you want to use a hard water high in calcium sulfate. So, you know, like home brewers and we as brewers, we add salts in the mash tun as well as in the kettle to get a water composition that we want. You know, softer waters generally great for making lagers. So that's why in Eastern Europe they had, you know, softer water. They made a lot of lagers in those.
We are talking about beer. This is Dave Shlom, the host of the Blue Dot Report, and my guest today is Terrence Sullivan. He is from the Sierra Nevada Brewery. Terrence, let's talk a little bit about things that can go kind of wrong or off tastes. The idea that, and I've heard this before from my kids who are homebrewers and my son-in-law who's a professional brewer, that beers can be skunky. Explain to our listeners, what does skunky mean?
Skunky, well, and I told you this yesterday on the phone, was that a lot of consumers kind of, if they get an off beer, they just say, oh, it's skunky. And it's not always skunky. You know, we have a very high level of quality at our brewery, and we actually encourage, you know, our consumers, if you get something that's off, let us know. Get in touch with us. We usually do a retrieval kit. We'll try to get the beer back, see what's actually going on, because it's just going to make us learn more and make better beer, right? And you know, one of our difficulties as brewers, and this is for every brewer, beer is handled in what's called a three-tier system in the United States. So we actually can't control what happens to the beer as it goes down the road. So we sell it to a distributor. A distributor sells it to a retailer. A consumer buys it from the retailer. So once it's out of our hands,
you can't control the temperature where it's going, the truck it's in, and whether it gets really hot or okay.
And really what we do is we actually have contracts with our distributors, and we ship all of our beer is refrigerated. Even beer that goes to Europe is on a refrigerated, reefer. That goes, and anything that goes down the road is actually refrigerated. And when it's held at the distributor, we actually require them to, hold it cold. Heat plays a major factor in all this, but skunky beer is due to light interaction with hop compounds that are in the beer.
So, any kind of light or sunlight?
No, it's a certain wavelength. It's 550 nanometers.
Okay.
And
so that's fairly short. That's like, that's yellow. That's like in the middle of the visible spectrum.
Yeah, and that actually cuts. So when you're brewing and you're adding hops to a kettle, there's alpha acids in hops. Alpha acids, as you boil them, they become isoalpha acids. And once they do that, when you're drinking beer and the bitterness that you're tasting, a lot of that is isoalpha acids is creating bitterness on your tongue when you're drinking it or the back of your mouth.
So there's an actual chemical reactions going on your tongue while you're drinking beer.
Yes.
And so you're doing science every time you have a swallow of beer.
Yes.
I'm going to do a little
even
science
our listeners,
right now.
Our listeners can do science with us. So what happens is natural sunlight will break a bond in the isoalpha acid and create 3-methyl-2-butene-1-thiol, which is...
Say that three times real fast.
I know, I can't.
Okay, don't.
But what that is literally skunky.
By literally skunky, you really mean that, don't you?
Yes, it's actually the same compound that is in a skunk that they use for protection, right? And us as brewers, we don't want, we want you to enjoy our beer and not smell a skunk while you're drinking our beer, right? So brown bottles is the one, cans obviously are going to keep out any kind of light and probably the best container to...
So that's why Sierra Nevada bottles are brown.
Yes, yes, and most breweries are. So if you look at certain like green bottled beers,
I was just going to ask, what about green bottles? Not as good.
Not as good. No, and
Let it be low
and
brown.
And right, or Heineken's a classic example, right? If you get a can of Heineken, now they actually have it in can, and you get a bottle of Heineken, pour them. And taste them side by side. Or listeners can do this too. I mean, literally pour a beer into a – now you know that there is certain beers that are in clear glass. Miller is one of them, and they actually have a chemically altered hop compound.
So that they can do that.
So they can actually do that, and it doesn't skunk the beer. But if you take, one of our beers, pour it into a clear glass – set it out in the sun, and literally this takes seconds. So about 30 seconds, your beer will be fully skunked. And that's how we actually we train our staff, our sales staff, and they do these off flavors with distributors and retailers, and let them know how important it is to.
So probably not a good idea to pour your bottle of beer into a clear glass on a sunny day and put it out on the picnic table and go play volleyball and then come back and drink it?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll be skunky, but
some people like
that. Like a little skunky, Okay.
Yeah.
But when you look at that, there's all sorts of things that are happening in a beer, and literally once you bottle a beer, everything's going downhill from that point forward. And that's why I talked about earlier about heat, why, temperature makes a profound difference in beer. And I always, tell people is, if it's the last place you're going to go shopping before you go home, get your beer at that point. Don't buy the beer and stick it in the trunk of the car in the summertime and drive around town.
The beer comes last.
Yes.
Okay.
And don't store it in your garage. You know, keep find it cold. A cool, dark area because
store in a cool, dark place.
Yes, and that's one of the things is you know we're always striving to make the best beer possible, and one of them is reducing the amount of oxygen. Oxygen plays a huge role in, you know, a lot of wines. You want them oxidized a little bit, and it brings out some nuances. There's very few beers where oxygen plays a benefit. The only time oxygen really is a benefit to a brewer is when you're dealing with yeast. Yeast mm-hmm. needs oxygen to grow, just like you and I, to live. And so that's the only point in the entire brewing process where we actually introduce oxygen to beer. So, you know, we take strides. We work with our crown liner supplier so that the barrier, you know, because when you think about it, a crown on the top of a bottle is – it's not a lot of surface area there to keep out any oxygen coming into that bottle. So we take great strides in making sure that the material is a nice barrier from any kind of oxygen getting inside the bottle. So,
we've got just a few minutes before we go to break again, but the next thing I'd like to kind of start touching on is home brewing has become a very popular activity in our region. And I'd like to maybe ask you, what are some of the things that, like, if you were going to give some really good tips to people that like to brew beer at home, what would be like, what are some of the things that, like, you really want to get this right to be successful?
Right.
What would be one of those things?
My brother homebrews all the time. And one of the things is, like, actually record what you're doing, you know?
Scientists do that.
Yes, you know, and document what you're doing. How much grain are you adding? How much hops are you actually adding? Weigh them out. Invest a little bit in certain things. You know, we talked about temperature earlier and how important temperature is. And, you know, but really the number one thing is your senses that you have, your taste, your smell. You know, and one of the things I used to tell all of our new brewers that came on at Sierra Nevada is always, like, taste the grain, rub the hops, drink the water. You know, every single day we drink, you know, we have different stages of water. And in sensory, and by the way, I'm missing sensory, which is my favorite part of the day to do this radio broadcast. Huh? So, but we're doing our own sensory, right? Mm-hmm. And so you want to taste every aspect of it. So as it's starting to ferment, you know, it's not going
to... You want to taste that and get a sense of what that's like.
Absolutely. You know, we bring in samples that are in the queue for being filtered. Those that are, you know, 10 days into fermentation, we're tasting those beers. We're tasting beer once it's packaged. We're tasting our bottle-conditioned beers 10 days later, and then we say, yes, it can go out. But that is one of the key things for homebrewers is, you know, the water, tasting the water, rubbing your hops, and really, you know, paying attention, documenting what you're doing, and you can get consistent in making, you know, the beer that you love or, you know, your friends love.
And we're going to be going to break here in a moment. You're listening to a special edition of the Blue Dot Report. This is our Oktoberfest edition, if you will, and we're talking about the science of brewing beer with Terrence Sullivan from the Sierra Nevada Brewery. If you're enjoying the show and all of the Science Friday programming you get here every Friday on NSPR, here's the number to call. This is the Blue Dot Report, Oktoberfest edition, and we're here talking about the science of brewing beer with Terrence Sullivan from Sierra Nevada Brewery. And Terrence, I'd like to just share an observation with you. I've noticed over the years that many scientists that I know love beer. They love to brew it, but they enjoy drinking it. It seems to be really a beverage of choice in the scientific community. I did an informal poll on my Twitter account and got a lot of reaction from scientific friends of mine saying, yeah, you know, we love beer and they like good beer. They like, you know, craft beers, like the kind of thing that you're involved with. But some of the things that I enjoy about beer are just the simple things. As a physicist, as a physics teacher, physics dude, I'll sit there and I'll look at a glass of beer and I'll watch the bubbles rise from the bottom and watch them get slowly larger and larger. And my physics brain starts to kick in saying, okay, well, as the bubble rises, the density around it is less. And so the buoyancy is causing it to rise. And so the bubble's expanding. And then I watch it and then I see it get to the top and it becomes foam. And then I notice things like, you know, when you walk along with a glass of water and it's full, you tend to spill it. But right. If you walk with a full glass of beer, you don't. And that's not just because you love your beer and you don't want to spill it. It's, you know, you would think it'd be the opposite. You're walking around with right. a glass of beer, you're probably going to spill it. But
I've
actually, the foam on the beer causes a dampening to the system that causes it not to
right.
spill. And that's
right.
something that engineers are studying now to, you know, think about making, for example, rail cars that are carrying hazardous materials, they're liquids, right. a layer of foam on the top can make them more stable in case of accidents, things
right.
like that. So there's just lots of things that occur to me just staring at a noble, humble glass of beer, which brings me to those bubbles.
Right.
Why is beer carbonated? What's that all about?
Well, during fermentation process, the yeast is actually producing alcohol and other flavors, sulfur compounds, esters that, you know, maybe in part, you know, if you look at our Keller Weiss beer, the esters that are in that is isoamyl acetate, and that's banana. So when the yeast is actually producing that, you know, people ask us, oh, do you put bananas in this because it smells like a banana?
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, the yeast actually produces that. And if you look at like our pale ale and the celebration ale we're enjoying now, a lot of like apple characters that is produced from the yeast fermentation. But one of the byproducts as it's producing alcohol in these esters and sulfur compounds is carbon dioxide, CO2. So every beer as it's fermenting is going to have a certain amount of CO2 in solution. What we do as brewers is we increase that CO2 content to carbonate the beer fully and give the beer a little bit more life. I had a professor, Dr. Michael Lewis at UC Davis, that used to always, and he was from Wales, and he used to always give, you know, because he's from Wales, he's got to give you a bad time if you're from the United States, you know, and all of his students are from the United States.
Because they know beer over there.
Yes. And also, too, you know, they know football, you know, and that's what we call soccer, you
mm-hmm.
know. So he always had his all of his classes were on Monday night in the fall to punish us students so that we couldn't go and watch Monday night football, you know. But one of the things he used to say is, I don't get it. Why Americans love pain, you know, and we're like all sitting back going, what are you talking about? And he was talking about CO2 content in
the
beer.
Fizziness of our beer.
Yeah. And if you go, those people that have enjoyed a pint in London, carbonation levels are much lower than what they are in the U.S. and especially cask condition. If you come to our brewery on a Thursday night, we're usually serving cask beer, much lower in carbonation than a normal beer. Or if you look at we do a nitrogenated stout, so it has very little CO2. Or if you look at like Guinness, that's nitrogenated, much lower CO2 content.
So you're substituting CO2 for nitrogen?
Yeah, absolutely. And it creates, you know, a denser foam layer, a cascading. It's beautiful, beautiful looking beer when you're pouring it.
You're also reducing your carbon footprint.
Yes.
So you're helping. You're helping the environment.
Absolutely.
I think that's wonderful.
And so, but what he was referring to is that pain is, you know, CO2 is acidic. And so when you actually take a sip of beer, there is pain receptors on your tongue, and that's what the CO2 is attacking. And so literally, like take a sip of beer and hold it in your mouth. The longer you hold it in your mouth,
do you feel that on your tongue?
Yeah, you can feel the pain, you know. And
the little
so that's
bubbles
what
attacking
used to always
your,
say.
Your taste buds.
But CO2 plays a huge role in beer and different styles of beer. Certain beers should be more carbonated than other styles of beer. You know, you look at something like an Irish stout, you know, I brought up Guinness, should be low in carbonation, you know, to kind of accentuate the roasty malt characters and those kind of things in the beer. So
let's talk about you brought a couple of samples with you today. Of course, the most famous beer from the Sierra Nevada line is Pale Ale. And then you brought the Celebration Fresh Hop IPA, and it has the beautiful – I always love the pictures on the labels of Sierra Nevada beers. Yeah. They're just lovely.
This guy's don't a, you want to get – you want to hang
it,
out in
it
that
makes
cabin.
Me want to go be in that cabin as long as there's plenty right. of Sierra Nevada beer. You could even put it out in the snow
yes.
and keep it cold. Yes. And it just looks yeah. wonderful, cozy, beautiful place.
This is my – I mean, every single – year when this comes out, I know that the season has changed.
Winter is coming,
and I cherish it until it's gone.
Explain to me though, what exactly is an IPA, and how is that different from, say, a beer that I like, a lager I might get, or a pilsner? Right. What is an IPA?
IPA stands for India Pale Ale.
Is that a historic reference?
Yes.
India Pale.
Yep. As the story goes, that when England was colonizing India, their soldiers, obviously everybody loves beers, right? And soldiers definitely love beer. They would bring pale ale around, ship it around the horn, bring it to India. And by the time it got there, it was always spoiled, you know, literally months on the sea. So brewers in England were actually tasked with producing a beer that was a little bit more stable for the soldiers. And so literally bringing in more hops. Hops have an antimicrobial benefit to them. Beta acids that are in hops will actually inhibit certain bacteria that will spoil beer, turn it sour, or, you know, turn it to vinegar. Those kind of organisms actually are inhibited by hops. And so a richer hop character in an IPA. And then, you know, in the U.S., our IPA is a little different than, say, in England. English IPAs were usually higher in alcohol, much more malty. You know, if you look at it, actually English hops, totally different than what we grow in the U.S. You know, English hops are more earthy, kind of spicy characters to them, where American hops are more really, well, what I like to say, kind of in your face. You know, we have certain descriptors for American hops of being piney, citrusy, grapefruity. Grapefruity almost to the point of literally like the smell of cat urine. That intense, you know, and so
yes, that sounds like in your face.
Yes, that is in your face. Yes, and
you're not going to be coming out with Cat Box IPA.
No, absolutely not. But if you sit here and you sip our Celebration Ale, is classic American hops, the sea hops, Chinooks, Cascade, Centennials. Centennial hops impart a real kind of floral character to this beer, almost like rose petals. Fresh rose petals, so a real rosy. If this beer was 100% Centennial, you could taste it and go, wow, that's like sticking your nose in a rose, you know. And then Cascades, very piney, literally like fresh cut pine tree or pine needles, has that character and a little bit of citrus notes of that kind of grapefruity. So that's all together in that one beer.
And then you brought me something special here. Tell me about what this is. This has got a beautiful bottle. If I could describe it, it's a beautiful black bottle with a stopper on top that looks like
it's a cork in a cage.
Cork in the cage. It's beautiful. Yes. What is this?
That is Trip in the Woods. That's a new series that we're coming out with. And the idea behind that is
Ale aged in bourbon barrels.
Yes. We're starting to expand our barrel program. We put in a barrel room here in Chico and a little small one out in Mills River, North Carolina. But the idea is to take bourbon barrels that are still a little wet. Put some beer in it, and only certain beers are really worthy of actually spending some time in these barrels. We use wine barrels. We use port barrels. We've used rum barrels. All sorts of different types of spirits and wines that are aged in barrels. And you impart a little bit of that character into the final beer. But that's Maillard's Odyssey, which was
Who is Maillard?
Maillard's reaction is what that's named after. So the actual literally browning of
so it's know, a it's yeah. a it's a reaction. It's again, we're back to science.
Yeah, we're back to science. And so so literally that and this is a real rich porter boiled for long extended periods of time, causing that browning reaction, that Maillard's reaction within the kettle. And so we thought this was a nice, really rich beer. It would benefit from laying on some wood and getting a little bit of that vanilla bourbon character into the beer.
Well, if it tastes as good as the bottle looks, it's got to be fabulous because it's just gorgeous. Let's talk about, for our listeners who, you know, who are really interested in beer, maybe might be interested in becoming home brewers. And we have a huge area that we cover here, and you
Absolutely.
Know, it's a fascinating hobby, and it's very rewarding. I know the people that I know that brew homebrew really enjoy it. It's more about the making of the beer than just the drinking of it.
Right.
You have Beer Camp.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have a program at our brewery called Beer Camp, and we literally today we're hosting veterans, all the veteran employees that work for Sierra Nevada. And then out in Mills River, we're actually doing one simultaneously.
That's in North Carolina.
In North Carolina. And they're doing one with we don't have as many employees because it's a pretty new brewery out there, but some local veterans that are actually coming in. And so we actually host a consumer-based beer camp twice a year, usually a contest around it. So if you, tune in to, go to sierranevada.com and sign up for our newsletter, you'll find out all about this. But really, it's an inside peek into what we do to actually make a beer. And, we take you on a tour and you get to taste a lot of great beer, but you really got to kind of get to see what happens from inside and be a part of Sierra Nevada. And when you're talking about homebrewing, I mean, that's literally how I develop my love for beer and wanting to actually get into making beer as for a living. And so there's homebrew shops everywhere. So, look up your local homebrew shop, go there. They are very willing to.
Is it an expensive hobby to get started in?
It can be. It's not expensive to get in. And definitely there's plenty of clubs. I know Chico has a club. Redding has a club. There's all sorts of clubs around the North State. And find a club. Go to a meeting. In essence, you don't even really need to start with any equipment. There's plenty of people in these clubs that would love to, show someone what they do. I mean, we're all very when you make beer, it's almost like your own
kids.
It's
a bonding experience.
Yes, yeah, and so you want to share it with people. And so, homebrewing is the essence of making beer. I mean, that's where Ken Grossman started. I mean, he had a homebrew shop, and it's still in existence in Chico, and that same shop. So.
Terrence, I just really thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today, and we could probably spend hours and not tap into the depth of your knowledge about beer. You're just very impressive, and your enthusiasm for beer definitely comes
across. Well, you put a beer in front of me, so.
Yeah. Well, no, you put a beer in front of me.
That's right.
Let's be clear there.
Okay.
I appreciate that you brought stuff for us to taste while we were talking about this. We just had been tasting it. Later on, I will seriously actually drink one of these. But so thank you very much for that. And I've learned a lot about beer today, and I appreciate the science and craft of beer much more than I did just an hour ago. So thank you for that. And to our listeners out there, if you've enjoyed this program, support this very special resource you have, NSPR. Norstedt Public Radio brings you very unique programming. And if you like the Blue Dot Report, which I know you do, support us right now by going to the phone, give us a call, or go to the website and let us know you enjoyed this program. And I'm Dave Sloan, reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.